What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna make a scene between me and you on my rocking bicycle that's built for two. Thanks for tuning in to Out There today. It's Wednesday. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Today's show is going to be about the Lucio Perez and the action that happened on Monday, October 16th, outside of the federal building in Springfield that houses ICE offices. Lucio has been targeted by ICE. Well, he has a bracelet now, and last I heard, he was scheduled to be deported, though he had to buy his own ticket. There may be things that have happened in the court system that I don't know about. So Lucio has been living in the U.S. since 1996 and is a father of four children and a leader in his Springfield church and community. He fled Guatemala due to a U.S.-backed military regime that committed genocide. And so the action that happened on Monday was coordinated largely, I think, by the Pioneer Valley Workers Center to demand that ICE approve Lucio's stay of removal petition. So today's show, I'm going to play. I have an interview with Liza Neal, as well as an interview that my housemate Clarissa did with myself. But I'm just going to start with just a couple minutes of preparations, some of the personal preparations that I was doing for this. It's Sunday night, October 15th, 2017. Tomorrow morning, there's going to be an action at the ICE office in Springfield in defense of Lucio Perez, who ICE is planning on deporting on October 19th, this Thursday. At a meeting tonight, I took on the assignment of making armbands that say Free Lucio to be worn by people who are willing to risk arrest at the action tomorrow. My assignment is to make 30 of them, so I'm writing Free Lucio with a black permanent marker on white t-shirts that I'm cutting into strips. I'm writing his name again and again and again, Free Lucio, Free Lucio, Free Lucio. I'm glad I could do a task that didn't involve computer work. The repetition gives me time to think about this man. Who is this man? And his four children. And his wife and his life here. My housemate's friend, Lucy, was just visiting and said bye before she left. Lucy, Lucio, I wonder if she feels a special kinship to this man. She knows about his case as well, and she does. She's done work with immigrant rights and farm worker rights. What will happen tomorrow? No one knows. It could feel just like another thrusting of swords at windmills. Well, nonviolently, of course. But it could also be a small part of a movement for justice for people who live here and are threatened with being torn from their homes and families at any time because of their documentation status, even though they work just as hard or harder than anyone who was born here, and love just as much as anyone else, too. I think of the abolitionists of the 16 and 17 and 1800s. It was all part of a struggle, and the struggle continues to make this country, this planet, but particularly this country, because this is where we are, a more fair and humane place and welcoming place for all of us who find ourselves here now. I'm just going to interrupt this clip to say that I'm jumping to like a 1 minute clip of Monday's action in Springfield on the October 16th.
There is no reason why our people that call Western Mass home and work and pay taxes should not live in fear.
Right.
This is happening all over the city of Springfield. This is happening all over our region. And if we don't stand up, and not only in the city of Springfield, but in all the chambers of Western Mass, so we can make it a real deal that, you know what, this is not going to continue to happen in Western Mass. Not in our house.
Escucha, estamos en la lucha. Escucha, estamos en la lucha.
Okay, so the next clip is, yeah, so that was, the action happened on Monday, and there were like 18 people arrested. I was one of them. And then the next clip is from Tuesday afternoon back at home in my house with my housemate, Clarissa Lyons, who helped me out with my radio show. She said, how about I interview you? I said, okay.
So Ruthie went and got arrested at a rally, and I wanted to ask some questions afterwards about some of what happened. So the first one is, I just wanted to know a little about the rally in general and just maybe like a brief chronology of your preparation beforehand, mm-hmm. all the way up to the arraignment that just happened this morning.
I'd have to look at a calendar to think about my preparation, but I guess I would look back and say that I've been involved with the Pioneer Valley Workers Center for, I think, a couple of years now. Going to some meetings, taking part in like the art workers and arts show and sanctuary in the streets training, things like that. In this particular case, the case around trying to get a stay of deportation for Lucio Perez, I think I've been involved. Like every week, the Workers Center has put out a call, like to make a phone call, or there was an action in Springfield at American International College a few weeks ago, and I've tried to be involved with that. I've visited Jim McGovern's office in Northampton. I've written a letter to the governor. I've called ICE offices multiple times, so I feel like I've been involved in the campaign. That's sort of like building, like escalating the way. So I wouldn't feel good about just going to get arrested for something that I hadn't tried other venues or been engaged in other venues for. But on this issue, I feel like I've given a good faith effort to try other avenues and to work other avenues as well. So more about preparations for yesterday's action in Springfield. There was a nonviolent direct action training at the Workers Center that I went to Tuesday evening, like a 3-hour training. There were maybe 20 people there. It was led by Jeff Napolitano. And we talked a lot about nonviolence and what that means. Like, how do you determine if something's violent or nonviolent? And I don't know if you want to give any specific examples about that from that training.
Sure, yeah.
So one of the things that often happens at nonviolence trainings that I've been to is the facilitator will create a certain scenario and then ask people who are at the training to say, on the scale of between violent and nonviolent, where would you put this? And on the scale of effective and ineffective, where would you put it? So like in one training that I went to before a Black Lives Matter march in Boston, the trainers had like tape on the floor, masking tape on the floor, and made like this X, like grid, whatever, like an X and a Y axis. Mm-hmm. You know, the far end of the X axis was violent and the other end of the X axis was nonviolent. And the far end of the Y axis was ineffective and the near end was effective. So there was kind of like a quadrant made, mm-hmm. and people in the training would walk over and position themselves in the part of the quadrant that they felt described the scenario, how they felt about the scenario. So, for example, a scenario might be spray painting the federal building in Springfield saying, free Lucio. And so is that violent or nonviolent, effective, ineffective? And then people would talk about why they felt how they did. Or another scenario might be in the middle of the night with no one around, no one getting hurt, breaking the window of TD Bank to go in and, I don't know, do something nonviolent.
Hang a sign.
Yeah, hang a sign. Or like something that I thought of is like an ICE van that's transporting people to a detention center, letting the air out of the tires. What about if you let the air out of the tires by, you know, depressing the valve stem versus slashing the tires? Anyway, so thinking about these things and what does it mean to be nonviolent, and what core tenets of nonviolence does a person hold to? Also, I want to be clear that there's not a judgment around violent or nonviolent. Different things, people, you know, need to do different things in different times. So that those are lots of good things to think about, like during the trainings leading up to something like this. What else? So there was that training. There was also that I went to this past or last Tuesday. There was also a potluck meeting Sunday night before the Monday action, talking a lot of it about logistics and the plan. Also, a big part of this is just getting to know the people that you're going to be with and building relationships. The thing about the nonviolence or violence, one of the things that kind of came into play during the action yesterday, can I jump to that or you want me to stay more focused?
Okay. No.
So during the action yesterday, there were probably 140 people. That's what the paper said. There was around 140 people total. And I was guessing there's like between 100 and 200. So I think that's right. That gathered at the federal building or whatever it is in Springfield. And did a Jericho march around it. And then 18 people who had, I think most, if not all, had been to a nonviolence training earlier in the week. We linked arms and sat in front of the front door, with actually a couple of front doors. And we had been there not very long, and it was like 9 in the morning. And a worker came to get in. And this building houses lots of different things, like the school department. It's a big downtown Springfield building. And the ICE office, it's kind of complicated to me, like if the ICE isn't even actually there right now, something's under construction, but it's a symbolic entrance to the ICE office. So a worker came in with a broom and a dustpan to get in to clean the building or something. And we were sitting with our backs to the glass doors that opened outward. And he sort of stepped into the seated people and was like, hey, I just need to get to work. And someone from inside the building, one or two people, I couldn't even really tell, that seemed like they were unhappy that we were there and that may have been like property managers or something, like pushed the glass door open into the backs of the seated people, just like shoved it into there. And there was kind of almost this like the physical, this physical struggle to open the door up against us and this guy to force his way in. And in that, the first time it happened, I was glad I wasn't on that end of the line, because in that moment, there's so much going on. You're like, oh, what do we do? We're here because we're blocking the door, right? We're like, why are we here? But it was pretty easy to come to the realization that, no, we're not going to have a physical confrontation with anyone. And so then we ended up moving our line like 3 feet. Forward. Like, we're not going to physically like hold back someone who's trying to get in the door. It's very much a symbolic action anyway. but yeah, that in that moment when I looked down the line and I saw the people that were directly involved with that, that was when I was thinking about the nonviolence training. I'm like, okay, we're nonviolent. We're not trying to, you know, make any enemies here or have a confrontation. We're just trying to show our like solidarity with Lucio and the issue at hand.
It sounds like that moment could have been even harder if you hadn't had discussions beforehand with a bunch of scenarios and kind of felt like a team going in. If you had all just sat down, there would have been, and then somebody had tried to push through you. But yeah. Since you had established all of those relationships with each other and kind of talked about different things that may come up, even though you hadn't specifically talked about that.
Yeah.
It sounds like you problem solved on the spot successfully.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but in terms of preparations, those are just things that I did. But clearly, other organizers and people involved did so many other things. Mm-hmm. There was so much more going on behind the scenes that I didn't even know about in terms of organizing, orchestrating this whole. It was kind of like a street theater production and all the different characters involved, especially Lucio, who was there and spoke, as well as his oldest son.
His son, yeah. So I kind of see that we're in this time of increasing social and political polarization. And so you are arrested by the police, which is this institution, and you are part of a group of people trying to organize to fight immigration, customs enforcement and police oppression of people of color. And I wanted to know kind of how, given the kind of zoomed out perspective of organizing against oppression and increased social political polarization, how did you interact with your arresting officer?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you kind of reconcile the two things of humanizing the individual while fighting the institution?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess first I would say that the police officers were very gentle with us. I think it helped that we were white, middle class or upper middle class. I don't know. Some religious leaders, that all made them, they knew a lot of eyes were on them and a lot of eyes of people with power. So they were very gentle with us. I've heard it was a bit different from the Black Lives Matter, blocking of the X that happened a couple of years ago when there were this a lot more people of color and it was more about Black lives. So they were super polite with us. The person that happened to walk me from the line after they put on the zip tie handcuffs. Anyway, so the officer that was leading me from where I was sitting to the car, I remember they had my arm and I didn't know if it was a male or a female. It's a short, round officer that seemed pretty friendly. And I kind of felt when we were walking down the line, it was maybe, 30 yards to the 20 yards to the police cars. We were walking through the line of people and other police officers. I kind of felt this kinship with this person, because it's we're both playing this game. We're both playing this theater game, and we both know we're playing this game. Just the way that you, when you get arrested intentionally as part of a direct action, it's just this game, the strategy of trying to bring attention to an issue. So I was actually trying not to giggle. Yeah, I don't know. It just seemed we kind of liked each other in the moments that we had. And not that we really talked or anything. When we got in the car, I was in the car with another woman with Pat, who had also gotten arrested. And then there were two police officers in the front. So we talked a little bit. Pat was like, so how long you been a police officer? Oh my God, I said 30 years. And the guy that had arrested me said he'd been there for 31 years.
And did you sense any tension in kind of the police knowing that you're trying to resist? I mean, ICE is not police, but they wear they wear insignia. They wear things that say police on their uniform sometimes. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, it seems like the action was speaking against police arrests or police, police pull over dark-skinned people in this area more frequently or with higher consequence. Maybe that's not a fact. I shouldn't cite that. Police do pull over.
It was the situation. It was Lucio's case.
It was in Lucio. Exactly. I guess that's what I'm trying to think of. Lucio was originally pulled over by a police officer.
Or his children.
Children were in the car.
The car was surrounded.
And the car was surrounded. Yeah. And that's kind of what led to the situation that he's in now. So did you feel you know, the two of you in the back seat, the two of them in the front seat, did you feel any, was there any, like, tension? Or were you like, oh, I kind of want to like these people because I'm trying to humanize them, and I kind of want to not like these people because I'm trying to fight against them?
No, I didn't feel any tension. I mean, I imagine it's different with different officers, but I didn't. I don't know how it is within the law, within law enforcement branches. So, you know, I really can't speak to if they feel any, like, relationship with ICE, or if they're like, that's a different department. We're just local police doing our local thing. The feds are, you know, different. Yeah, but no, I didn't.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm playing an interview that my housemate Clarissa did with me. My name is Ruthie Woodring, and that's Clarissa Lyons, my housemate, interview me about this action that we did in Springfield on Monday. I've got some more of that interview that, let's see, should I play that or should I play the one with Eliza? I think I'll play a little bit more of this one, and then the second part of the show, I'll play one with Eliza Neal talking about sanctuary cities. Liza Neal is the director of spiritual life at Hampshire College that was also part of the group of 18 that was arrested on Monday.
And yeah, that's my experience as a white person, as a white female.
My last question is, what are your reasons for showing up?
I think, you know, we're always looking for something we can do. How can we plug into a movement? And we all have different skills. Some people are really great at coordinating a letter writing campaign. Some people are good at, you know, coordinating ride share rides and giving rides to people through the AAN network, which is what Clarissa does. One of the things. So I just felt like it's something I can do. I have the flexibility in my schedule that I could take the day off and do this and sit in a jail cell all day. And I have the flexibility in my schedule that I can go back to court for the arraignment or for whatever future court dates may happen. And like in terms of immigration and Lucio's case, it just really doesn't make any sense that our government would spend resources to break families apart. Like, we have enough social problems in this country already, and the government's going out of their way to tear down a good thing. Just doesn't make any sense. And then, of course, then I also think off a lot about slavery and abolition and like when I think about, is what we did effective? Will it bring about any great change? I mean, I don't know. I feel like people, abolitionists worked for hundreds of years, 1600s, 1700s, wasn't until like 1860, whenever, that slavery was outlawed. And so all these different things that people did were part of a movement. And I think especially trying to change people's hearts and minds about how we see citizenship and how we see the right of migration, like how just the word citizen, I feel like, is thrown around a lot. I think we should be careful about how we use the word citizen. Maybe resident is a better word. But then they're strangers, and should they be treated with less respect? Anyway, so what are some of my motivations?
Yeah, is there any story that has, where you saw maybe somebody being treated differently than you, or you being treated differently than somebody else in a way that you kind of, in your, was a moment, or I'm sure there's been many moments where you've thought, oh, I'm going to stand with people when I see that I have rights and privileges that other people don't.
Yeah. I think when I was living in Chicago with the Catholic Worker, a lot of the people I met there, think about Carlos or Fidelfo, like guys who had come from Guatemala or El Salvador, who, in Chicago, near where I lived, there's a recovery center for survivors of torture. And so guys who had survived the civil wars in El Salvador and Guatemala, you know, I ended up living with some of these guys, and the nightmares, literally and figuratively, that they had been through or were living with, a lot of which were the violence which had been supported by my government. I think like that really helped me want to like create a safe space for people and change my government's policies towards Latin America. So plus I've always liked the Spanish language and speaking Spanish and communicating that way with people who speak Spanish as a first or second language, like Guatemala. I'm thinking about like Guatemala.
Native.
I don't know. I don't really feel like I have any very interesting stories to share that I can think of right now. Have I told you any that you can think of? I mean, I think a little bit about this time when I was on this shuttle bus in Arizona.
That's what just came to my mind as well, of things you've told me.
Yeah.
Oh, when someone was taken off.
Yeah. Yeah, once it was like 10, 11 o'clock at night, and I was trying to make my way down to the Mexico border with my bicycle to meet some friends for a bike ride. And I'd taken the train, the Amtrak, as far as I could. It dropped me off like at 9 or 10 o'clock at night with my bike. And then there was this shuttle bus that mostly took Mexican Americans from like the Tucson, Phoenix area down to the border. And I think it was a Friday night, the end of the work week, and the van was full of guys, all who looked brown skinned and spoke Spanish, all going down to the border after their work weeks to go back to Mexico, I think, with their paychecks. And so like we're just going down the highway, and there's some like Tejano or something, Mexican music playing on the radio. And then I see the driver look in the rearview mirror and just kind of mutter some bad word. The next thing you know, we've been pulled over by ICE. I guess it was INS, La Migra, then. Yeah, it was INS then. It was 2002. And they ask everyone in the van for their ID or something. I can't remember exactly what they asked them. But then two or three guys didn't have what they wanted, and so they took these guys off. And these guys just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And then the van kept on going, and the mood was just like really deflated. And you know, also me being there, I'm like this one white person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that affected people and the level of trust and what they would say to each other either. But like they were trying to get out of this country. They were trying to leave this country. They were on the way back to Mexico. Why would ICE pull over guys that were taking the fastest way out of here they could?
And had just spent their week growing food for a lot of the nation.
Yeah.
And were probably not paid very much for it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. You've been listening to an interview with myself, Ruthie Woodring, by my housemate, Clarissa Lyons. I was part of an action on Monday in Springfield at the ICE offices near the federal building some federal building in Springfield, where 18 people were arrested and 140 people or so were there in support of Lucio Perez, who's gotten a deportation order for tomorrow from ICE, last I heard, unless things have changed. Hopefully things have changed. So this is Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM in Northampton. And we're going to take a little break, and I'll play some Merle Haggard.
American ranching consists of a mansion where illegal immigrants do much of the labor by hand. They sneak them through customs till time comes to bust them, then haul them back over the border to their own native land. With a ragged sombrero and not much dinero, they'll be back again when the Rio Grande is down low. Border patroller, don't stop a stroller, cause the Mexican immigrant is helping America grow. Viva la Mexico, go where they let you go, do what you can for the land. Take home dinero and buy new sombrero, and come back again when you can. A gringo, you smart aleck lingo, when he stole his land from the Indian man way back when. Don't he remember the big money lender that put him a Lincoln parked where his Pinto had been? The almighty peso that gives him the say-so to dry up the river whenever there's crops to bring. Is this a good neighbor to take all his labor, then chase him back over the border till he's needed again? Viva la Mexico, go where they let you go, do what you can for the land. Take on the dinero and buy new sombrero, and come back again when you can. Viva la Mexico, go where they let you go, do what you can for the land. Take on the dinero and buy new sombrero.
All right, I'm going to go back to some more of the interview with Clarissa and me. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Out There plays every Wednesday from 4 to 5. You can listen to archived editions of Out There at weatherbeer.com/out there. Democracy Now! Will be on at 5 o'clock. And thanks for listening.
And then there was another time that I was hitchhiking out of Atlanta, Georgia, and these guys picked me up. I'm pretty sure they said they were from Guatemala, but they were like mom, and they were speaking another language, I think that they said was mom, that I couldn't understand. And they had three teenagers in the back. I guess they were teenagers. I couldn't tell how old they were. And I'm pretty sure they were human smugglers of some sort. But they gave me a ride when I was hitchhiking from Atlanta up to the Kentucky line. And I was super grateful to them. Yeah. Just, I think of that as generosity mm-hmm. that people have extended to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you were probably aware in that moment of the difference in your freedom of movement. You were hitchhiking and mm-hmm. got a ride from, was offered a ride, and meanwhile the kids in the van with you had very little freedom of movement. They were forced into a certain mode of transit.
Yeah, and they told me they hadn't even gotten out of the van for like, I don't know, 18 mm-hmm. or 20 hours.
Hi, guys. Is it okay if I join you, or are you...
A line of people on both sides. Interview.
That's all that I had written down.
And it's clear.
That's
where I go anyway. But yeah, join us.
Okay.
The one other thing I want to... Funny thing about the... getting arrested yesterday, when that officer was walking me to the van. Mostly there was like a line of people on both sides, people that had come there for the demonstration, you know, people with the signs that said, like, for example, keep this family together, talking about Lucia Perez's family. And then on the sidewalk, right before we got to the police car, there was a man who I assumed to be a local man filming with, or just recording with his cell phone. He was like, I don't know, maybe 60 years old, short, thin, black man. And he said, yeah, go to jail, right where you belong. Inside, I just started laughing because it was just so bizarre.
One of my other favorite small moments that you told me about is, can you tell me what you did in your cell and what you think other people, or what other people said they were doing in their cell?
Well, so the cells were like you might see in a movie, just like very bare. There was a metal shelf that they called a bed with nothing on it. There was a toilet against the wall with no toilet paper and like rust and all over the edges. And then the bars and the sliding door covered with plexiglass. You couldn't even really hear. So you couldn't really talk to your neighbors, even though you thought there were probably, there's probably someone you knew in the cell next to you, but you couldn't even really hear. And there was also some bright lights which cast shadows on every wall. And so I entertained myself by dancing and watching my shadows on the wall and jumping up and down off the bed shelf thing as part of my dance moves until the second shift guard. I was standing up on the shelf bed and she said, get down from there. And then I also entertained myself by looking at the plexiglass. After I was in there for maybe a couple hours, I realized there was actually a lot of graffiti, a lot of legible, like, graffiti etchings in the plexiglass. And I don't know what people were etching it with, because they, you know, they search you, you take off your shoes, you give them, they pat you down, you give them, you empty out your pockets, you take out your hairband, you can only have one layer of clothing. Actually, I wore a bra just for this occasion, thinking, I bet I can get away with two layers if one of them is a bra, because I heard it was cold in there and I wanted every bit of warmth I could. Anyway, so it's like there's this etching on the in the plexiglass, and I finally, after a couple of hours, I was like, oh, if I look really closely and line it up against the light just right, I can start to read what people have written. And the thing that I found most interesting, well, so there wasn't a whole lot of different etchings, because only the people who managed to figure out a way to etch had done it, but there was something dated 1987, up to something dated 2017. So just thinking about 30 years of women being in this cell behind this plexiglass was interesting.
All right, that does it for the interview with Clarissa. Now I'm going to play some from Liza Neal. She was actually the person in the next cell over. I thought she was there, and a couple times I yelled, "Hey, Liza!" I yelled through the crack in the sliding door, but I never got any response because the sound, it was so difficult to hear or to get communicate messages when you're locked in that cell. It made me think of lots of people who are locked up. All right, this is Liza Neal talking about sanctuary cities and stuff.
My name is Liza Neal, and I am the Director of Spiritual Life at Hampshire College, and I'm an ordained United Church of Christ minister.
All right.
I suppose that's it.
So we met at the Action on Monday outside the ICE building. So on the way back in the car from after they released us from jail Monday night, you were talking a little bit about the history of sanctuary cities in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you tell us about that?
Sure, yeah. So it's in the Hebrew Bible or the Torah or the Old Testament, depending on your frame. And seven cities were designated as sanctuary cities. Mm-hmm. And that meant that you could go there if you had committed a crime or were accused of committing a crime, and receive sanctuary there and not be taken out of the city, basically. And of course, you know, this is a time where, generally speaking, if someone killed someone in your family, you killed someone in their family, so on and so on and so forth, or you killed them, right? Mm-hmm. And so this was sort of a way to avoid a blood feud, for instance. That's not the only reason, of course, but...
Yeah. Like a way to stop the cycle of violence, kind of?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's certainly my interpretation of it, or at least a way to contain it, uh-huh. so that it didn't, wrap up an entire community in it. Uh-huh. And of course, there's, like everything in the Bible, there's debate about how long this was in effect, and mm-hmm. whether or not it's historical, mm-hmm. or, you know, and things like that. But none of that obviously is sort of proven in the sense that we can't definitively come down on either side of that. Mm-hmm. But biblically speaking, there are these cities which were declared sanctuaries. And so then you have kind of moving through time to the medieval period, and that had morphed into... the idea of churches as sanctuary, mm-hmm. and it had expanded into the sense that, and we're talking Europe, medieval period in Europe, and you could seek sanctuary in a church for any reason. It wasn't, uh-huh. you know, whatever reason you might need sanctuary, you could uh-huh. go into a uh-huh. sanctuary. And then, you know, the authorities would not come after you, uh-huh. basically.
There's a couple things that come to mind immediately. One is sort of a side tangent of, like, Australia is like a whole sanctuary continent.
Right. Oh, totally. Yes.
And then the other thing that I'm thinking of is if... whole cities, or if churches were sanctuary for any crime at that time, and I think about now the level of stress or debate about that some congregations, churches in Northampton are having right now about right. whether or not to become a sanctuary church just for people who are undocumented, who haven't committed any crime.
Right.
Like, wow, this seems like they were so far ahead of us medieval ages in terms of forgiveness or acceptance or trying to...
Right.
Anyway, so go on.
Right. Of course, you know, it was a very different time in the world, and you had no separation of church and state. And mm-hmm. So, you know, there were other factors.
Yeah, okay. That's a very simplistic interpretation. Just a simplistic reaction, anyway.
So, but, so then in the 80s, there were a lot of refugees. The 1980s. Yeah. I should specify that, since we were just talking about medieval. There were a lot of refugees from Honduras, and they were not classified as refugees, so they could not legally seek asylum here because the United States was funding the war that was going on there, and so therefore wouldn't classify them as refugees. So that's when the what was called the New Sanctuary Movement began, mm-hmm. and it drew on these sources of, you know, sort of medieval history and the Bible as its part of its foundational argument, and then, of course, on top of that, the morality and justice, or rather immorality and injustice of what was happening. And so churches would take people into sanctuary, and so if you go into sanctuary, it's a very public thing. So it's not the same as, you know, like going into hiding, mm-hmm. because part of, being in sanctuary is engaging the community. Mm-hmm. And so the church, in addition to, you know, housing the person or family, mm-hmm. Is also committing to do outreach in the community, to doing education, you know, engaging with the press, and, you know, getting sort of the wider community to understand the issues of what was happening.
Wider.
Go on.
So, which at the time, you know, at that time, that what was going on was not sort of widespread knowledge. And so, so it was a, you know, I mean, it was a great thing to do anyway, but it was not something that was sort of happening elsewhere in terms of doing that kind of education and stuff around what was going on. And there were churches that were part of the movement that didn't take people into sanctuary, but, you know, had declared themselves as that, but it, you know, just didn't happen in terms of taking folks in. But a number of places did, and there were, you know, people, there were pastors who went to court. No one was ever convicted. So, you know, which we, which, you know, we tell pastors now, like, historically, of course, there are no guarantees here because, you know, you are actually doing something illegal, right? Because it's not, I mean, the argument is we're not doing something illegal. But, you know, it's a moral thing, and it's a trusting the community to recognize sort of and respect sacred space, regardless of sort of where someone is coming from, and thus, you know, recognize that it would be wrong to enter into that space and take somebody out of it. Mm-hmm.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to an interview with Liza Neal, the Director of Spiritual Life at Hampshire College. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I got some more of this interview with Liza. Liza was one of a group of people, 18 people, arrested on Monday, October 16th, in front of the federal building that hosts the ICE Immigration and Customs Enforcement offices in Springfield. Democracy Now! Will be up at 5 o'clock. Here's some more from Liza.
So then now, of course, to bring up sort of the history, so now you have the new sanctuary movement. Although now it's just the sanctuary movement. I've dropped the new since I was in the 80s. And of course, you know, in addition to you have cities declaring themselves the sanctuaries, but that's a different thing, right? Because the cities are talking about, obviously, there's no engagement around sort of sacred space or anything like that. And they're really talking about having the police not, you know, report information or not sort of work with ICE and things like that, as opposed to when a church declares sanctuary. It means taking someone in, and then that person, you know, lives there. And they can't leave at all, ever. I had heard of a situation where somebody went down the street to the convenience store, and they'd been in sanctuary for a while. And the second they went out, they were picked up.
Wow. So it's a whole different kind of jail.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, much, much more comfortable one.
Anyone can come to sanctuary or anything.
Yeah. People are, you know, you've got food. And
it's probably every jail better should
than,
be.
Better than jail food. There are no guards. But yeah, you do have to stay there, you know, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And there's no knowing how long you'll be there. Yeah. You know, it could be years. There are folks who've been in sanctuary for years.
Wow.
Wow. There hasn't been a case yet in Massachusetts, though that may change.
Where? Of what?
Of sanctuary.
Of someone taking sanctuary?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. But these are such times that I think that will change very quickly.
Yeah. So in the Northampton and Amherst area, so I don't know if you know where any churches are, if any churches in this area. I say Amherst because you're at Hampshire College. I don't know if there's like a chapel there that could be a sanctuary or what. Do you know? This may be a question for someone else, but do you know about if any churches have become sanctuary churches officially? I know some are in the process.
I want to answer your question about colleges first. Okay. In the sense that because there's been conversation about whether or not a college chapel could declare itself. I don't think that could be completely answered until somebody tried it, but probably not because, you know, it's owned by the college. I think, you know, there was already some argument at Amherst College about that question because someone had sort of said this is a sanctuary and the administration was like, no. Even though the college had made a statement that they weren't, you know, they were not going to pass on information and things like that. But they were like, but let's also be clear that the chapel is not going to be a sanctuary church. So it's a little bit of a different situation. And in terms of, I'm not really at liberty to say.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. in terms of your other question.
Yeah. Another thing that had come to mind, which isn't really a question, but just a comment, is that, like, with a church being a sanctuary place, like, anyone can use it, whether they're white supremacist or Donald Trump or whoever. So it's just interesting to think about what that might all mean.
Although, The difference being, of course, that it's the church makes the decision in terms of who they would welcome into sanctuary. So certainly that's theoretically true.
But there's plenty
and yet unlikely.
Yeah, but there's plenty of churches with strong patriarchal and white supremacist values.
It's true in terms of values. And yet doing sanctuary is a huge burden for the church, in terms of the care of that, you know, person or family, and in terms of the risk for the church, in terms of the relationship with the community, the relationship with law enforcement, and, you know, so there are many, many, many reasons why communities choose not to, because it's not an easy thing to do to provide sanctuary and do that kind of work. And it's a huge commitment, and it's a commitment that you're making, like, for a completely indefinite period of time. And thinking about sort of what you have to do in your life that then you need a community to do for you, you know. I mean, obviously, like, you know, if there's a kitchen in the church, then you can cook for yourself. But, you know, food has to be bought for you and brought in for you and... you know, if there's not a kitchen, then food has to be cooked elsewhere. And then, you know, so there are all sorts of millions of little details into doing that. And, you know, so in terms of that piece of it, the commitment that the congregation is making, and then in terms of the sort of relationship with the public. And,
yeah.
That's an interview with Liza Neal, who's the Director of Spiritual Life at Hampshire College. You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. There was much more of the interview that I did with Liza earlier today. It was pre-recorded, and where she talked about her and her partner's 6-year-old daughter, and how I asked her, how did you tell your daughter about the action and that you were going to jail, that you'd been to jail? But I don't have time to play that. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to Out There here on Valley Free Radio. That's it. Down to his shoes.